It gives us even more pleasure to welcome Jonathan Safran Foer, whose first novel, Everything is Illuminated, came out in 2002 and won awards, including the Guardian First Book Award. His second novel, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, in 2005, is now being made into a film with Tom Hanks and Sandra Bullock. And Eating Animals, the book we're going to talk about, came out in 2009. It's your first non-fiction work. And in fact, just after that, I think Tree of Codes came out, didn't it? Which is a die-cut art book. They're bringing those out at the same time, quite. And apparently makes booksellers very nervous because the pages are very delicate. So we're going to discuss Eating Animals. And I think the question, really, to begin with is, you know, why? Why are you moved from fiction to non-fiction and to this subject in particular?
Well, first of all, thank you all for coming. It's a very impressive room to be speaking in. I think David Cameron gave a speech in here this morning. So I don't know if you, I guess you call that good company? I guess so.
Yeah. Oh.
Highfalutin company, in any case. That might have been a very American expression.
No, highfalutin, very, okay. Very English. And
thank you as well for helping me tonight for conducting this conversation. So, in a way, your question begs another question, which is, why would you write anything at all? You know, why would I write a novel and then move in this other direction? And I think that the answer, why would I write this, is the same as the answer, why would I write a novel? And it's that there's material that I want to be careful with and that I want to spend time with and explore, and then maybe if things go in a certain direction, and usually they don't, but if they happen to go in a certain direction, then maybe want to share it as well. I write much more that I don't share than that I share. So I have always been a writer who gravitates, not by choice, but by necessity, toward things that I have very strong feelings about, or that I think a great deal about. People have asked me why I write about family so often. I find that a super peculiar question. You know, nobody asks J.K. Rowling why she writes about wizards so much. That is a very sensible question. We all grapple with family. We all have lots of strong thoughts and feelings about family. So I cannot help but write about them. I ended up writing in a somewhat oblique way about September 11th in my second novel. I was a New Yorker. I was living in New York, rather, when it happened, and I have been living in New York ever since, and so, like every other New Yorker, it's something that I had very strong thoughts and feelings about, and I found it not only difficult to resist the pull of it, but I decided that it would be a very bad idea to resist the pull of it. I felt a very strong pull toward the subject of eating animals. I'd felt it since I was a kid. Like most children, I thought there was something odd, or maybe problematic, about the idea that we would kill animals and eat them. You know, my parents would give me a stuffed animal when I cried. When they would read me to sleep at night, almost all of the books had animals as heroes. We had pets come in and out of our home, and we were instructed to treat them in a certain way. And if we didn't, we were punished, because that's not who we are. We're not the kind of people who are callous with animals. But then there was this other thing that my family did. We would eat animals. And like most things that your family does, it was invisible to me until somebody pointed it out, and that person was a babysitter.
A babysitter, yeah.
We had this radical, in every sense of the word, babysitter one summer when we were young, who had, you know, patches on her bag and listened to rock music and would dye her hair a different color every few days. And when we were served chicken at one meal, she said she wouldn't eat it. And I asked her why not. And she gave what is maybe the most naive and also most sensible answer one can give to that question, which is, I don't want to hurt things when it's not necessary. And I found that totally compelling as a 9-year-old. I just couldn't think of a refutation. I am now 33, and I still cannot think of a refutation. Why would I hurt things unnecessarily?
I mean, in a way, that's the theme of the book.
Yes. So the book actually isn't about whether it's right or wrong to eat animals. The book is about, in the year 2011, when we have, what, about 6 billion people going on 7 on the planet?
Lots.
When there are 50 billion animals factory farmed every year in this world, not an imagined world, not on the moon, not 50 years ago, not 100 years in the future, but in this world, when these are our choices in front of us, what do we want to do? And what will that say about who we are? That question took on an urgency when my wife became pregnant. Before then, I was a pretty casual person in the world. Certainly with food, I didn't give a lot of thought to it. I would eat, you know, sometimes I was vegetarian, sometimes I wasn't. I would swing back and forth, often many times a year. And I certainly didn't give a lot of thought to reaching for a Coke or something like that. I now have a 5-year-old. I would not reach for a Coke for him. But in a way, that's obvious because we all know the reasons why that's not a good drink to give to a 5-year-old with any regularity. It becomes more complicated when you start to mingle story with nutrition and start exploring the ways in which the foods that we prepare and eat and how we eat those foods together tell perhaps the most important story about ourselves as individuals and as a family.
You start the book with that story about your grandmother, which you is also you use in extremely, everything is illuminated. I mean, your grandmother and, you know, and family, clearly all of this ties in together very, very strongly for you. Why was that so powerful for you? And if you
the story in particular?
Yeah.
Okay, so my at the beginning of the book, I tell a story that my grandmother told me when I was writing the book, although in fact she told it to me since I was a kid. Mm. You know, we used to go to her house many weekends and stay over, and the whole time would be spent at her kitchen table playing Uno. I don't know if that game has made it across the ocean.
Yes.
Yes, thank goodness. I now play it with my kid every single morning. And eating food. And that was like, the table was her chalkboard, basically, where all of the life lessons were being presented, although often very subtly in ways I didn't understand until quite a bit later. In any case, she told this story about how at the end of the war, she was from Eastern Europe, when she was fleeing the Nazis east toward Russia, and the Nazis were always a step behind her. At the very end, the greatest risk was actually not the Nazis, but malnutrition, that there was so little food that she really wondered if she was going to be able to survive. And she tells the story of how one day, toward the end of this period, a Russian farmer saw her and saw her condition, and he went into his house and came out with a piece of meat for her. And I said, oh, this man saved your life. Already thinking, as an American might, we should go find this person and give this person some money, you know, like, which I sort of tried once to disastrous results in another context. But so, and she said, no, I didn't eat it. And I said, what do you mean you didn't eat it? And she said, it was pork. I wouldn't eat pork. And I thought it was the most ridiculous thing I'd ever heard.
But that story continues. I mean, that the resonates, so that obviously resonates for you, and that's what brings this book about for
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. Because she said, I said, not even to save your life. And she said, if nothing matters, there's nothing to save. And I think the moral of her story was not that you should be kosher, but that we have to draw lines in the sand. You know, lines that if we should cross them, it would require us to no longer be ourselves. We might not even be able to fully recognize ourselves anymore. Each person draws his line in a different place. But if you're somebody without such lines, then you stop being a person.
So this book is you kind of thinking aloud and finding out exactly where that line is for you. I mean, the research was, you spent 3 years working on it. And, I mean, you went to a farm in the middle of the night with an activist. Could you tell us a bit about that?
So, you know, if you wanted to find out where your apple juice came from, it would be fairly easy. You could call the company, probably get an invitation to the orchard, probably see the presses. It's not a big deal. If you want to find out how your bagel is made, the bakery will let you behind the counter, probably. Here's the flour, here's the water, here's the machines. If you want to find out where your meat comes from, you're totally out of luck. I mean, you might as well be asking to learn a military secret. Literally, and I would encourage everyone in this room to try it. Just take a package out of your refrigerator and look at the name, not because it's a special company, but because it's what you've been buying, and call them and say, I'm a curious consumer. I've heard all kinds of stuff about meat, and I would love to just know for myself. So at the beginning of the research for this book, I wrote lots and lots of letters to many different companies explaining myself in what I thought was a very forthright way. I'm a new father. I'm curious about this food, the environmental effects, the health effects, the animal welfare. And I'd just love to come see some farms and meet some farmers. And I was met with silence in almost every single case. And when I did get a response, it was some excuse, some reason why that wouldn't be possible. So I ended up going with these animal activists who break into the farms in the middle of the night to document conditions. It was incredibly scary. It was incredibly funny in retrospect, not at the time. And it was just strange. I mean, the whole time I was thinking, what am I doing here? Why am I here? Both because it was such an unlikely situation for me, and also because why would a person have to climb a fence in the middle of a night, find an unlocked door among dozens of locked doors to see where his food comes from? It's crazy. This is a product. You're not only giving money to these companies, you're ingesting their products. You're feeding it to your loved ones. And we have very good reasons to think that it's terrible for us and for the environment. So that was my way of seeing these farms. I did it maybe 2 dozen times.
Oh, that, yes. Wow, that
with means this activist. I only wrote in full one of the break-ins just for narrative reasons.
Did you stay in touch with C, the activist?
No, I didn't. We've emailed once or twice. She's somebody I really respect. I respect her idealism. I feel like she's, you know, it's good to surround yourself with people who keep you honest. And she, despite my barely knowing her, and I wouldn't consider her a friend and she wouldn't consider me one, she really keeps me honest. I have her in the back of my mind when I am getting lazy about choices.
The argument of the book is, I mean, you say it's not a simple case for vegetarianism. What in the end, what line did you feel that, you know, where, what was your final argument?
Well, there are two arguments. There's a personal argument and a kind of global argument. And the personal argument, it's not an argument, it's a personal conclusion, is that I'm a vegetarian and that my kids are vegetarians. And I came to feel that that is the line for me. Knowing what I know about how meat is produced, knowing what I know about the size of the world and the number of people on the planet and the only ways to feed that number of people meat, I felt that I couldn't participate in the animal agriculture industry, even the best aspects of it. And there are some very good aspects of it. But then it gets more complicated when you start talking to somebody else. I mean, it always does. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sharing your opinions and also suggesting what you think is the right way to be. I think what's important is that we focus on the starting point and focus less on the conclusions, because often conversations about meat rush right to the conclusion. Are you a vegetarian or are you a meat eater? These are the only two options in the world. You know, either you don't eat meat or you eat meat, or you're some kind of hypocrite in between. They often rush to some other extreme places, like is your belt made of leather or do you swat flies? Or I was just speaking with somebody a few minutes ago who said, if you were on a desert island and it was just you and a cow, you know, what would you do? Well, we're not on a desert island. And we can't let the desert island excuse us from living.
So are we not going to find out what you and the cow would do on a desert island?
What would I even do with a cow if I decided I want to eat it? I mean, I'm not even sure. What would I slaughter it with my toenails? I don't know. How would I snap its neck? I'm sure I wouldn't be able to do it. The cow would eat me if we were on a desert island together. My point is, it's very easy to get lost in hypotheticals. It's very easy to get lost in extremes, and it's very easy to become aggressive and defensive, and to forget that in broad and deep ways, we all agree. So if I were to say how many people in this room think it's perfectly right to kill animals and eat them, I'm not actually asking it. I imagine if you were the general public, probably about 95% of you would say it's perfectly right to eat animals. That seems to be right now a widely shared opinion. If I were to instead ask, how many people think it's right to have a farm industry that's the number one cause of global warming, that produces more greenhouse gases than everything else in the world put together? Or if I were to ask, who thinks it's important that we continue to be able to use antibiotics when we need them, when our children need them? Or who thinks animal cruelty, You know, who wants to keep pregnant pigs in a cage so small that they can't turn around? These are things that everyone really agrees on. You have to be at the very, very margins of society to want to keep pigs in cages like that, to want a farm system that's environmentally destructive in those ways. And so if we focus on this broad agreement and then think about what can we do with that, like what are the directions in which we could move? Well, some people will become vegetarians. That is what I chose to do. I should say it took me like 20 years to choose to do it. It was not a light switch that I flipped and then I suddenly lived differently. Some people will say, I'm going to eat less meat. Maybe I will only eat it for lunch. Maybe I will only eat it 5 days a week. Maybe I'll simply reduce my meat consumption by one meal a week. If Americans reduce their meat consumption by one meal a week, it would be environmentally the equivalent of taking 5 million cars off the road. It's a very powerful statistic. It's hard to imagine the person who isn't persuaded by that statistic. It's also hard to imagine the person who can't imagine reducing their meat consumption by one meal a week. You know, if someone says to me, I can't become a vegetarian, I'm sorry. Like, I agree with what you're saying, I just can't do it. I like the taste too much, it's too important to my family, it's too convenient, whatever. Fine, I understand that person. Someone says to me, I'm not willing to eat one less serving of meat a week. That begins to sound pathological. So, you know, I think the answer to these problems resides in beginning with the starting point, this broad agreement that there is a problem, and starting then with the next meal, and then adding meals after that.
But you are a very committed vegetarian. I mean, you have written this book to illuminate sort of the factory farming system for people and to make, I mean, for yourself, yes, to explore why you have become vegetarian, but also presumably for other people so that, I mean, presumably you hope that they will follow and become vegetarian as well.
I think it's the best way to eat, but I'm not naive. I think it's not a way that most people are going to eat too soon. I think it is the way most people will eat eventually, but we have to get to the eventually, and I think it's going to be a slippery slope. Like, I think that as we allow ourselves to engage with this problem, as we allow ourselves to fill a hypocritical space, you know, we have such resistance to being hypocrites that we would prefer to be fully ignorant and fully forgetful all the time.
I mean, one of the difficulties, I think, is to sort of mediate that position. And you, at one point you say, you know, people either never eat animals or never seriously question eating them. I mean, do you really, I mean, that's quite a strong statement because that indicates that unless you're either vegetarian or you've just never really thought about it. Do you think that's fair?
No, I think what I meant was we have grown to believe that the only two positions are I will be a vegetarian or I'm just not really going to think about it. There are some people who occupy a middle ground, conscientious omnivores, I guess you might call them. I think we need more conscientious omnivores.
And your family farms as well, the people like Bill Nyman and his wife. I mean, that was a very interesting part of the story for a lot of people, I think.
Well, you know, surprisingly, the strongest advocates of this book have been farmers, not animal rights groups, as you might suspect. Farmers hate industrial agriculture. I mean, it's killing them. They've lost control of their techniques. They've lost control of their profits. You know, as many farmers said to me in one way or another, I didn't become a farmer because I hate animals, and I didn't become a farmer because I want to trash the environment. They became farmers because of the diversity of the life, the ability to apply this very special kind of wisdom, often it's handed down, the ability to be close with nature rather than see nature as an obstacle to be overcome, and to feed people in a very direct way, and all of that has been lost.
Do you think that actually it was the contact with the farmers you had while researching the book that slightly modified your position away from straightforward vegetarianism to a kind of moderate support for the family farm system?
It was a combination of that and also what I wanted to be the most productive approach to the problem. So in terms of the farmers, I met farmers who treat their animals better than I treat my dog. I mean, to be open-eyed and honest about it. They give them all the food that they want, the food that their bodies naturally digest. These are animals that haven't been bred to become ill. They allow them to engage in all of their species-specific behaviors, and then they slaughter them. So a lot of people focus only on the slaughter. My perspective is not that. I am not... I think it can be very problematic. I honestly don't know what I think about it. My book is not about the right for an animal to continue living. in part because I witnessed on some of these farms lives that are better than not having been lived. If I, you know, I'm not a great fan of anthropomorphizing, but sometimes it's unavoidable. And on some of these farms, I thought, you know, if I had the choice, would I rather be this cow at Nyman Ranch, you know, alive for this period of time, engaging with my peers, eating good food, having an absolutely wonderful environment in just about any way you look at it, knowing that I would then get a quick and painless death that I didn't anticipate, as the majority of those animals do, not the majority of farmed animals, but those animals, I would take that over not being born. If you put me, gave me the choice of a factory farm, I would say, kill me now. You know, I don't want a second of this. And so then it becomes a little bit more of a curious hypothetical problem. But again, I don't think that's the problem to focus on. That's something that's interesting in an academic setting. But when we go to the supermarket, that's not the problem we're being confronted with. And when we're in a restaurant, that's not the problem we're being confronted with. We're being confronted with the problem of the factory farm.
When the book came out, presumably the reactions were pretty explosive. I mean, what unexpected quarters were you attacked by?
It was not explosive at all. At all. It was totally uncontroversial. That was the amazing thing. Before it was published, I had a conversation with another food writer who was telling me, you might consider getting a bodyguard because, you know, the industry is scary and people get very aggressive about this subject and prepare yourself. And I had the book vetted by two different lawyers and proofread by two different fact checkers, independent fact checkers. I was nervous. It wasn't a controversial book because it's not a controversial subject if you speak about it the right way. Is it controversial that we wouldn't want chickens packed body to body in cages? Is that really controversial? Is it controversial that we don't want our air and water polluted? It's not controversial. What's controversial are the hypotheticals. Is it right or wrong to kill animals for food? But that, again, that's not the problem that we're wrestling with right now. We're wrestling with the reality. What I did find interesting in the response was that there wasn't one from the industry, which is strange because I basically said they were evil for 300 pages. And I basically said everybody should withdraw their support and think of them. I mean, I mentioned people by names. I mentioned company by names. I said, Kentucky Fried Chicken has caused more suffering than any corporation in human history. I referred to the CEO of Smithfield as a piece of shit. You know, if I referred to The Guardian this way, I'm sure I would be sued. But if I wasn't sued, I would at least be corrected. Somebody would say, you know, The Guardian isn't perfect, but we do some things right as well. There was none of that from the industry.
Not any at all.
None at all. So what does that mean? That means either they agree with me, which I doubt, or they know what everybody knows, which is the more we think and talk about this, the less likely we are to eat meat. It only happens in one direction. The more you know about it, the less you want to eat it. It is a practice that entirely depends on ignorance or forgetfulness or silence. It doesn't work when people are speaking with one another about it. And so the goal of my book, to return to what you were asking earlier, was not to create vegetarians. It was to create people who talk about this. I'm convinced that people who talk about this are going to gravitate toward vegetarianism. But really, the goal was to get people to talk about it.
What about veganism? I mean, surely that's the logical end point.
Veganism is the logical end point, and it is, I think, the ideal way to eat. I have had a hard time with it. It's something that I aspire to, and that I've had a hard time with. I think it is, to be a vegetarian in 2011 is quite simple. I mean, I literally cannot remember the last restaurant I went to that didn't have something perfectly nice to eat for vegetarians. And it does not need to inspire any social discomfort at all anymore, at least not where we are now speaking. In some parts of the world it does. But veganism is harder. It is more difficult. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean we shouldn't try, but it's harder. And I am being honest about this because I think that I'm being honest about my own hypocrisy, that I know something is right and I am not presently doing it. Mm. I've spent 3 years learning why it is right and I'm still not presently doing it, at least not consistently. I am very sensitive about where I buy dairy products, but, you know, not always. Because I really do think we have to open ourselves up to this hypocrisy. It's like a necessary way station to making choices that better reflect how we think of ourselves and who we are, who we want to be.
And I mean, looking back at the book, with that, you know, what stays with you most still of the factory farms?
What stays with me most is that we're choosing it. I mean, that's the most horrifying thing. You know, this is not, the animal cruelty is present at every single corner. Whether it's how the animals are bred, whether it's how they reach the farm in the first place, if they're delivered from hatcheries, how they're treated in life, the kinds of foods that they're fed, the medical treatment that they're denied, how they're packed up for slaughter and how they're slaughtered. At every stage, it's cruel. And it's not cruel because of an accident. It's not cruel because of defective machinery. It's not cruel because of masochistic workers. It's cruel because that's the way we've chosen for it to be. We want it to be cruel. It is built into the business model. This is the most environmentally destructive thing that humans do by a long shot, and not by accident, because we choose for it to be this way. There are other ways of farming, but we have chosen this way. Smithfield in the United States had 7,000 violations of the Clean Water Act in 1 year. If they'd had 10, we would say that's not good. If they'd had 100, we would say this is a bad company that needs to be watched. 7,000 is a business model. They want to violate the Clean Water Act. They want to pollute the water. They want to pollute the air. They want to make antibiotics less effective for human beings. I mean, is it really what they want? Is it their goal? No. But they have full access to the information. They know what they are doing. And in the very same way that cigarette companies want to give human beings cancer, these companies want to destroy the environment. And we choose it again and again and again, and we're pushing it across the world. That's what's most horrifying, that we have a choice. We are not presented with a choice for many problems, or the choice is arduous and complicated. You know, so many of the worst problems in the world would require us to spend billions or trillions of dollars, require us to elect new governments, require us to find a new set of values. All we need to do here is pause, you know, when we're at the supermarket and when we're perusing a menu, to just stop for 1 second and say, is this really what I want? Is this the thing that I most want, or is it possible that there's something I want even more than I want this specific meal?
And do you still ever get cravings for meat?
All the time. All the time. I am not the kind of vegetarian who thinks meat is repulsive. I think meat very often smells good and looks good. I should say, over time, I have begun to lose my taste for red meat and chicken. I mean, it's really, you don't have to go to a chicken processing facility more than once or twice to begin to lose your taste for chicken. It's just gross. I mean, it's disgusting in a hygienic way. I don't mean in a violent way. It's also that. But the hygiene of it is so repulsive that...
what's the name of the pool?
The fecal soup.
The fecal soup that they dragged... Yes.
The animals are left to chill in these huge water baths by the tens of thousands where they cross-contaminate one another. And the industry refers to that liquid as fecal soup. Not PETA. The industry refers to it as fecal soup. I miss sushi, to be honest. That's a food that I really miss. When I see it in a restaurant, I want to eat it. I look at the table next to me, and I think, I wish I were eating that. That's better than what I'm about to eat. But you know what? So what? So what? Who cares? You know, humans are great at saying no to things that we really want. That's what makes us humans. That's what distinguishes us from animals. The other animals is that we have an ability to act against our cravings that no other animals have. Not to this extent. It may be that other animals have it, but not to this extent. People say, well, meat is natural. We've been eating meat for hundreds of thousands of years. Our bodies seem to have been designed to do it. Who cares? Our bodies were designed, you know, males seem to be designed, one could argue, to have many, many partners. We certainly have strong sexual cravings. That's not a justification for having sex with whoever we want, whenever we want it. We would say that that's a pathological behavior. In fact, we incarcerate people for acting on that instinct. So this is another instinct. I would suggest that the instinct to eat meat is less strong than the instinct to have sex. I mean, maybe there's no need to compare them, but I don't know how you would measure such a thing. You could put on one side and on the other side. I don't know.
Someone should do it. Someone should definitely do it.
My only point is, yes, I miss it. And I'm happy to share that. I miss it. It's good food, but so what? I miss lots of things, and I feel good missing them. I feel better missing them than I do having them.
Well, thank you. I think what we'll do now is open up for questions.